I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Frazier Glenn Miller, also known as Frazier Glenn Cross, has been charged with the murder on Sunday of a 14-year-old boy and his grandfather. They were in the parking lot of the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City. He's also charged with the murder of a woman on the same day in the parking lot at Village Shalom Retirement Community, both in Overland Park, Kansas. He also faces federal hate crime charges, even though none of the victims were Jewish. Miller has a long history of anti-Semitism and white supremacist activism, founding the Carolina Knights of the KKK and the White Patriot Party. He served time in prison for weapons charges and for plotting the murder of Morris Dees, founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He also testified against white supremacists in a deal with the FBI, and now there are reports that he may have been in the witness protection program at some time. Today on Radio Times, hate crimes, hate speech, and violent extremists. And we begin our conversation with Emily Bazelon. She's senior editor at Slate Magazine, also a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine, and she's currently the Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School. And Emily Bazelon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
So is this what the First Amendment is designed to do, to protect the hateful speech of someone like Frazier Glenn Miller?
The First Amendment is designed to protect hate speech, yes, but I think the really disturbing part of Miller's background went beyond hate speech. I mean, this is a guy who in many ways demonstrated his affinity and membership in the white supremacist movement in a way that should have sent out warning signals to the government. He should have been on their radar.
And you're saying he wasn't?
He was not, as far as I know. The Southern Poverty Law Center has tracked him for a long time, and they said that local law enforcement had never heard of him.
And in fact, we'll be talking with someone from the Southern Poverty Law Center a little bit later on in the show. But let me get back to this idea, I guess, of speech and action. I mean, clearly, this was a man who had racist and anti-Semitic beliefs and eventually acted on them. Three people murdered on Sunday. Where do we draw the line? If we're going to protect people's speech, when do they cross that line?
Well, the way the First Amendment works is that unless your speech is imminent incitement, in other words, unless you threaten someone directly in a way that it's clear violence could directly follow, then your speech is protected. And, you know, the United States is different from a lot of other countries that have legislated against hate speech in a broader way. But in our First Amendment tradition, there is a lot of room to say hateful and offensive things. And the notion underpinning that is that we believe in this very strong marketplace of ideas and that the best way to fight speech is with other speech.
And does that make us unusual when compared to our counterparts around the world?
Yeah, increasingly it does. Countries like Canada, France, Britain, Germany, India, South Africa, they've all signed international conventions banning hate speech. There's a recent Supreme Court decision in Canada that I think illustrates this contrast. So there was a fine against a guy who was distributing anti-gay flyers, and the flyers called gay relationships filth. And the Canadian Supreme Court upheld the law that had fined this guy and said that it was okay to legislate against hatred that is an extreme manifestation of the emotion described by the word detestation and vilification. We would just never have that kind of law be upheld in the United States. We would worry that, you know, who you detest or vilify is in the eye of the beholder and that this goes too far in encroaching on people's free speech rights.
But does this case raise questions for you about our First Amendment?
Not exactly. I don't think that Miller should have been arrested for his hateful speech against Jews. But I do think there is still a lot of room for the government to be tracking people whose speech and membership in particular groups demonstrates that they might be prone to terrorist acts like this one. And I was really dismayed to be reminded in reporting on this case that the Department of Homeland Security issued a report in 2009 about the prevalence toward violence among supremacist groups. And that report was effectively shelved. There was a huge amount of backlash from conservatives who felt like the Department of Homeland Security was kind of broadly tarring the conservative movement with the terrorist brush, as opposed to in a narrower way saying, wait a second, we shouldn't just be thinking about Al-Qaeda and Islamist groups. We also have to worry about right-wing extremists.
In fact, you say it, and you looked at a number of other people's works as well, is that when you look at, I guess, homegrown terrorists or terrorists with associations with right-wing groups, they've actually killed more people in this country than Al-Qaeda or Islamic terrorists.
That's right. So since 9/11, according to the New America Foundation, there have been 34 people killed by far right-wing ideologues versus 23 killed by people who are following Al-Qaeda-like beliefs. And, you know, those are daunting numbers, and they demonstrate, I think, that simply focusing on Islamists is misplaced and is going to miss some of the really violent, murderous threats that are out there.
So is this an argument to begin tracking some of these groups and some of these individuals?
Yeah, I think that it is.
Well, and in some of the reading about Fraser Glenn Miller, he apparently at some point had a point system for murder, numbers of points for black people, for white race traitors, for Jews, for judges, and the most points for Morris Deese. If someone has created a point system for murder, have they crossed that line?
I think not on its own. I mean, that is certainly disquieting, and again, it would be a reason for the government to have this person on their radar. Not necessarily proof, though, of a conspiracy to actually kill someone. You have to take steps toward actually committing a crime before you should be prosecuted for it. You know, otherwise, we're kind of in the world of the thought police and anticipating crime. But it can be very difficult after the fact when killings like this take place. It starts to seem like, well, all the signs were there, and they were missed.
Well, and I'm in the sort of perverse world that we're talking about. The victims, as it turns out, were not Jewish. They happened to be in a parking lot, in two parking lots, in Jewish facilities. But nonetheless, he's being charged with a hate crime. How do you understand that?
Well, the police think that he was targeting the JCC, the Jewish Community Center, as a Jewish facility. And, you know, the tragedy of these people's deaths, there's no way to see it as anything other than just an awful occurrence. But there is a certain irony here, if that's an appropriate word to use, in that I think JCCs have been places that welcome all kinds of people of different faiths. They aren't simply enclaves where only Jews go. And so one imagines that Miller probably intended to kill Jews, but he didn't.
Yeah, and again, we're learning day by day that he apparently testified in a deal with the FBI against a number of terrorists, and maybe, possibly, was part of the witness protection program. Again, I'm tossing this back at you, Emily Bazelon. How do you think through that?
Well, you know, in the 80s, Miller, we know, started a group affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina. And the Southern Poverty Law Center sued him. He was then blocked from running this paramilitary organization. He then moved and went underground. And then he got in trouble on some weapons charges and for plotting to kill Morris Deese, who you mentioned earlier. And he went to prison for 3 years. But as part of his plea bargain, he agreed to testify against other white supremacists. So I wondered if that had isolated him afterward, if, you know, people in the movement were very angry with him. But that does not seem to be the case. He was very actively involved in a website called the Vanguard News Network, posting on it more than 12,000 times. This is a virulently anti-Semitic, white supremacist website. And he was also out there distributing their materials and giving them money. So he was still part of the white supremacist movement, and I think it's a mistake to see him as a kind of isolated guy.
Your piece in Slate says, could anything have been done to stop Fraser Glenn Miller? Do you think anything could have been done?
You know, it's always so hard to have the counterfactual. But you certainly want the odds to be higher. You want local law enforcement to know this guy is around, to be alert to signals that he may be reaching out to other like-minded people. You know, maybe he shouldn't have had the weapons that he had, for example. And you would also, I think, want the federal government to have someone like this within its sights.
Is that an argument for surveillance?
It's an argument for good, you know, FBI and detective work. I don't think that has to mean the scary Big Brother kind of surveillance, but every police force has certain people who they see as potential troublemakers and are keeping an eye on in, you know, small or large ways. So I think there's a way to do this that does not then lead us down some really alarming surveillance path.
I was reading some interviews, I'm sure you have as well, people that knew him and described talking to him, saying, you know, he's a kind of a mild-mannered guy. Once you got onto politics, he wasn't shy about his anti-Semitism and his racism and his feelings about white people. But other than that, you know, he wasn't a sort of a ranting and raving person that you might find walking around a neighborhood.
Yeah, I never know what to make of that.
I don't either, actually.
So he wasn't a raving lunatic. Like, he didn't present as, you know, hallucinating, but listening to the tapes of him talking about his views, it's incredibly ugly, and he's very impassioned about it. So I guess the idea that, you know, he could also say please and thank you, I just don't know really what the relevance of that is.
But does it also say something about the internet, or, I mean, people's sort of sense of being semi-anonymous, or perhaps feeling that they can say things that they might not say in public?
Well, in this case, though, this is a guy who went on Howard Stern's radio show and said, you know, our politicians, things that are curse words I won't say on the air, but just incredibly angry things about Jews. So, no, I think in his case, he was very much out there in his own name expressing these extreme views.
Is there some kind of parallel between him and also the Westboro Baptist Church? I mean, the Supreme Court essentially said that their speech was protected. Can we, obviously taking away the murders, but can we talk about Miller's speech being protected in similar ways?
Yes, I think that is a relevant case. So that's a case in 2011 where the Supreme Court said that the Westboro Baptist Church could not be sued for emotional distress by the family of a soldier when the church had picketed outside the soldier's funeral with some very hateful speech about gay people and the military. And what Chief Justice John Roberts wrote at the time was that speech is powerful, it can stir people to action, and it can inflict great pain. But on the facts before us, we cannot react to that pain by punishing the speaker. And I think you see there this sort of First Amendment tradition that protects all kinds of speech, no matter how offensive.
Well, Emily Bazelon, thank you for getting our conversation started. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's senior editor at Slate Magazine, also a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine, and currently the Truman Capote Fellow at Yale Law School. We are talking about Frazier Glenn Miller, talking about hate speech, the First Amendment. And we're going to take a very short break. We have another guest waiting in the wings. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the Museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. Now through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Jane Goodall is known for studying chimps, but the roots of her work are in her love of trees.
To me, trees are living beings. They have their own personalities. I'm not being scientific here. I'm just talking about the way it feels.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Choir of Christ Church Christiana 100 supports WHYY and celebrates its 100th anniversary with a performance of Johann Sebastian Bach's St. Matthew Passion with orchestra on Good Friday, April 18th at 7 p.m. Christ Church's music program is known for its advancement of Anglican music and features an 18-voice professional choir. Conveniently located in Wilmington, St. Matthew Passion and the choir's 100th anniversary events at christchurchde.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about hate crimes and hate speech and extremists and the man charged with three murders over the weekend, 73-year-old Frazier Glenn Miller and a prominent white supremacist, former KKK Grand Dragon. He's also been charged with federal hate crimes. And joining us now is Daniel Filler. He's a senior associate dean, also professor of law at Drexel University School of Law here in Philadelphia. And Daniel Filler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
You were listening in as I was talking with Emily Bazelon. There are many questions I put to her. I'll put some of them to you as well. Do you think Frazier could have been stopped? This man could have been stopped?
Well, I think that Emily is right that the government could have engaged maybe more aggressive watchful eye on him, but we're very uncomfortable with that. So at the end of the day, I think it's really difficult, and I don't know that the police are going to be prepared to follow him out his front door each and every morning to see where he's headed and what he's carrying. That's a very difficult thing to stop.
And that's the line between thinking hateful things and even talking about hateful things and actually carrying them out?
Well, I think it's partly that. I think that when you look at these big kind of terrorist acts like Al-Qaeda was involved in, those involve a lot of plotting. There's a lot of detection you can do and intervention points that you can try to use to stop the offense from happening. You don't have that in a case like this. I mean, this is a fellow who walks out his front door and goes and does something awful. And there are probably hundreds or thousands of people out in the United States today who might do that on any given day.
What?
And it would be impossible for us to basically be following them every second and jumping on them the second they pull out a weapon, for example.
But he's not the only person to have hateful thoughts, to express hateful speech.
No, he's not. I mean, the discussion board that Emily's talking about, and there are others, have a tremendous number of people who express hateful feelings, some anonymously, some not anonymously. And I do think that local police forces and the FBI are engaged in, you know, watching and efforts to intervene. But again, when those are big projects that involve multiple people, that involve weapons that are other than guns, you know, bombs, mm-hmm. It's easier for the government to get involved. It's easier for the police to get involved. And that's the scary thing about the individual terrorist who uses the mundane, everyone has it at home kind of weapon. And it's extremely difficult to stop folks like that no matter what you do.
What do you think about hate crimes?
Well, I mean, I think I, as most people in this country, think that they are awful things, and particularly awful things. And there's so much history in this country and around the world of crimes being motivated by, you know, hatred towards people based on race, based on religion. But I also think more generally that when people attack, assault, and murder other people, irrespective of the motive, it's horrendous.
Part of my understanding about hate crimes is that if in the case of Frazier Glenn Miller, apparently well-known anti-Semite, he killed three people. They didn't happen to be Jewish, but they were on what sounded like Jewish-sounding facilities, is that it sends a message to other Jews that, yes, I'm going to kill these people, but I'm going to send a message to you that you could be next.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that terrorism is designed to put people other than just the victims in fear. That's the nature of terrorism, and that's the nature of hate crime. So you take this bad motivation, you do a small bad thing, and you create ripple effects. Surely, when we look back at 9/11, part of the agenda for Al-Qaeda was not simply to kill specific people, but if possible, to take down entire societies, or certainly and successfully taking down, you know, for example, financial systems and other aspects of American society and culture. And that's what an act like this one does. It puts many people, Jews and non-Jews, who use Jewish facilities, Jewish schools, Jewish community centers, in a certain degree of fear every single day.
Should we think of this as an act of terrorism?
I think it's fair to think of these as acts of terrorism, and I've been surprised that it hasn't been framed that way more. It's been framed as a hate crime, and maybe that's in part because we have this ready language of hate crime laws that have been debated, have been controversial. And I think it's fair to include this, as Emily did, in the basket of things that are terrorism and that, you know, organizations like Homeland Security ought to be attentive to.
But is there a danger with charging hate crimes that you end up charging people for their beliefs or even for their speech?
I don't really think that there's a problem with actually charging people for their beliefs. You're charging them for action motivated by hatred. And so in these cases, you are using, in many cases, statements, speech, as a method of proving the what motivated them. But of course, in any crime, maybe not any crime, but in many crimes, motive and intention is a factor. So we think of intentional murder, premeditated murder, and these are crimes where we look at motivation. And we look at, you know, feelings about racial hatred in other contexts. So if we think about our fair housing laws and our fair employment laws, we do care what motivates somebody to fire an employee or to exclude somebody. So we do think about motivation all the time.
But could we also say that, that a white man, a white male, could be a victim of a hate crime? I mean, the way we frame hate crimes?
There's no question that a white man could be a victim of a hate crime. And indeed, there are cases, and I know because I was a criminal defense lawyer in a few of them, where the defendants were African Americans charged with committing hate crimes against white people. In fact, if you look at the landmark Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court said that it was legitimate to have hate crimes, that was a case that involved blacks attacking a white person. So, in fact, it was African-American defendants, not a victim, that gave the opportunity to the Supreme Court to affirm these laws.
Should this case help get us to rethink our laws or just help us understand the implications of our laws, especially the First Amendment?
I don't think this case really should change how we think about these laws. I think it should make us recognize Kansas had a version of a hate crime law. Hate crime laws are doing things. The things they do really send a message. They're a public message about our view about hate crimes. They send a message to victims and their families that, you know, we're supportive. What they don't do, I don't think, is prevent these crimes. They're really not preventive techniques. They're more about public articulations of what we think about hate crime.
So it's not a deterrence as you see it?
I don't think it has any deterrent effect. I mean, I think that the problem is that a person who is motivated to attack a person because they're Jewish or because they're African American doesn't stop and think, well, I might get an enhancement because it's hate-based. These are highly motivated offenders, and their motivation is far greater than any small, medium, or even large law.
Excuse me, let me reintroduce you. That's Daniel Filler, and he's Senior Associate Dean, also Professor of Law at Drexel University School of Law here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about hate crimes and hate speech and extremists as well, of course, in response to the charges against Frazier Glenn Miller, a well-known white supremacist who is charged with killing three people on Sunday, raising a whole host of questions. And apparently, when he was arrested, he shouted, Heil Hitler, a well-known white supremacist to organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, who will be joining us later in the hour. They have been tracking him. What do you think about what we should do about people like Frazier Glenn Miller? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Justin from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Justin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question was, it's a little bit different than, I guess, me, what you're just talking about, but from what I understand, hate crimes legislation puts the hate, like the murder or the act, under federal law. And do you see, I guess my question to the associate dean would be, do you see using, you know, the use of hate crimes legislation by the federal government impinging on the state's ability to persecute people in the future?
You mean prosecute people?
Yeah.
Okay, very, very big difference there. But let me give our guest, Daniel Filler, a chance to respond. Thanks, Justin. Yeah, go ahead.
That's a great question, Justin. The federal law is not set up to replace state law. The state can still pursue charges. There are separate federal charges that are available and that the federal government can pursue. So this doesn't take anything away from state power. And these federal hate crime laws are actually pretty old. There were some recent modifications, but the federal hate crime laws have dated back to the 1960s. I think the big thing with federal law that people don't necessarily notice is that by having this federal jurisdiction, it makes resources for investigation more available, and both the federal prosecutors and the state prosecutors can benefit from that. So more than just the prosecution itself, bringing the federal government in actually is an aid to both jurisdictions.
Mm. Let me see what thanks for the call. Let me see what Paul from Hamilton, New Jersey has to say. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times as well.
Hello, Marty. For one, I haven't seen Eric Holder prosecute anybody for the knockout game yet. So whenever anybody talks about going after hate crimes, I always take it with a grain of salt. And secondly, I'd like to say if you're going to go after hate speech, then basically you'd have to go after the Old Testament Bible itself, because it teaches to put homosexuals to death. So Judaism itself would be in the crosshairs of hate speech laws because of what it teaches in the Old Testament and in the Talmud.
Yeah, but Paul, we're talking about the law here. We're not talking about the Bible.
No, but I understand. But if you're going to outlaw hate speech, then the Bible will be in the crosshairs and the Talmud of hate speech laws.
Well, yeah, well, I don't think anyone's talking about outlawing it, but let me see what our guest has to say. Daniel, go ahead.
Well, I think this actually brings up a point that we should attend to, because I think it can get confusing. And Paul has talked about hate speech laws, and what's not at issue in this case are hate speech laws. As Emily said earlier, the United States is incredibly protective of hate speech. So what we're talking about here is, in fact, hate crimes. And if you do some of the things that some people believe the Bible calls for, if you stone somebody to death, you know, decrying them for being gay, it is true that that is contrary to the law. And I think most of us agree, whatever you think, that that's not something you're permitted to do and ought not be permitted to do here in the United States.
Do you believe that you counter hate speech with more speech? I mean, that's the way to engage. It's sort of a cliche by now, but how you engage someone who has hateful ideas?
I mean, I think that is the American philosophy. The American philosophy is built on the idea that more speech will cleanse everything, and we engage negative or hate speech with more positive speech. In our experience, I think that's worked reasonably well. I think some European countries don't think it works as well. Obviously, around the world, there's a view that it doesn't work so well. I don't think that there is a correct answer to it, but I am pretty clear that in America, this is really not up for dispute. We are going to allow hate speech, and we're going to respond to hate speech, and that's our culture.
Well, and even thinking of the Westboro Baptist Church decision by the court, what was interesting is when there were these funerals, lots of motorcycle people and other protesters came and protected families who were having these funerals that were being protested by this hateful group, protected them and sort of stood alongside of them as a sign of solidarity.
Absolutely. In that case, you see it. I suspect you're going to see, even coming out of this case, you know, part of the reality is we don't have nearly as clearly defined lines in the United States as maybe some other countries. So who is African American? Who is white? Who is Jewish? Who is not? What is a Jewish community center? And as Emily points out, a Jewish community center is not an organization with, you know, a clearly delineated population using it. So I think one of the things that does make hate speech a little different in the United States compared to other countries is the diversity and ever-growing diversity and complexity of what each of us are in America. And that's part of our history, and that makes us different than, you know, a number of countries, for example, in Europe. It's just hard to figure out who is who in America sometimes.
Do you worry about the internet? I mean, the internet can fuel some of this hateful ideology.
I think that the internet certainly does fuel hateful ideology at times. It fuels all sorts of negative feelings. It's also an venting opportunity. So one could ask the question, and I imagine you could study this, does it help for these people to vent on the internet? Does it make them not feel the need to vent on other people? And I don't know the answer to that question.
Let me get, looks like Nori from North Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Nori. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a statement and part question. I'll be really succinct. But why isn't their religion ever a factor? Like, their extremist religious views are never brought under microscope. And the Westboro Baptist minister is a prime example. These people are preaching from the pulpit, and they're preaching hate. But their religion of Christianity is never brought under microscope. And the guest was asked, was it fair to use the term terrorist for this recent attacker?
Right.
And he said, I think it's fair.
Yeah.
But, you know, the following the anniversary of the Boston bombing, as soon as the event happened in Boston, they were automatically labeled terrorists. And whenever it's someone of Islamic background, they're always a terrorist. But all of these mass shootings, you had the movie shooting, you had the school shooting at Sandy Hook, and the word terrorism is never ascribed to these events.
Well, that's a really interesting...
And it's puzzling.
Well,
and I just want to close on this, please, Marty.
Sure.
We invade countries on the premise that they have terrorist training camps, but these hate groups, the Southern Poverty Law Center has counted 939 active hate groups in 2013, and most of them are operating in the backwoods of America, and nothing's being done. They're allowed to operate in isolation, and I just would like to close with that.
Well, no, I appreciate that, Nori, and you should know that we do have a guest from the Southern Poverty Law Center who will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. So I appreciate the comment, and I want to give our guest, Daniel Filler, a chance to respond to that.
I think that it's something that Americans aren't that comfortable with, going and examining the religions that are most common in this country. I think that's fair. I think that when we talk about Islam, particularly after 9/11, people are willing to say, well, there's radical Islam, and that's dangerous. But people aren't really comfortable saying, well, there's radical Christianity and that's dangerous. You know, these religions have strands today that are radicalized, and they do have – Paul really brought the point up. There are texts out there like the Bible which have suggestions of things that are not acceptable, not tenable, not part of our modern culture. But a few people will pull out language, the language that says you ought to stone people to death, and suggest that somehow that authorizes them to do it today. We talk about that with Islam. You're right. We really don't talk about it, you know, with Christianity or Judaism. But anytime anyone is using religion to go and attack others, you know, that's something worth looking at and talking about.
Nori, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Daniel, about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. Any final thoughts?
Well, I do want to focus on the way that these laws work. They really, as I said, they're about the symbolism. They're about articulating a message. And so people often complain that hate crime laws don't do anything more to prevent crimes. And that may be true. They don't deter things, probably deter offenses much, but they make an important statement, and perhaps more than anything else, they direct resources and expertise to these crimes. I worry about them being misused, but they're serving a particular function, and I think that at this moment we sort of come together agreeing that what happened in Kansas was a hate crime, and we know that in part because the crimes are on the book.
Well, Daniel Filler, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's Senior Associate Dean, Professor of Law at Drexel University School of Law here in Philadelphia. And do stay with us. We have another guest waiting in the wings. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from Social Justice Community Counseling or Child and Adolescent Counseling. More information about a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
Little kids giving us the business.
I like to start like duct tape businesses, so like you can make stuff out of duct tape, like you can make purses out of duct tape.
A 6-year-old and her startup plans from a program that encourages young girls to hold on to their big ideas. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. His was a genius that would reveal itself early, develop swiftly, and vanish all too soon. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra present a four-concert Mozart celebration, the final three symphonies, and the three piano concertos of 1785. Mozart tickets online or at 215-893-1999. April 24th through the 26th at the Kimmel Center, a Mozart celebration with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. On Sunday, three people were killed outside two Jewish facilities near Kansas City. The man charged with their murders is Frazier Glenn Miller. He's a well-known white supremacist who reportedly shouted Heil Hitler when he was arrested. He's also charged with a hate crime. Even though the victims were not Jewish, we are talking about hate crimes and hate speech and extremists. And joining us now is Heidi Bierich, and she is director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly investigative journal called The Intelligence Report. And Heidi Bierich, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for inviting me on. Appreciate it.
You know this man quite well. Help us understand who he is.
Yeah, unfortunately, I did know him quite well,
exactly.
Almost personally. He is a guy who has been involved in the hate movement and anti-Semitism since his teens. He told a reporter at one point that at 17 he read a publication, an anti-Semitic publication, and with 2 minutes knew that that's what he needed to devote his life to, and that's what he did. He ran a Klan group, the White Patriot Party. Recently he's been posting more than 12,000 times on an anti-Semitic website, and, you know, anti-Semitism almost doesn't capture the hatred that Frazier Glenn Miller had for the Jews. It was visceral and very deep.
And wanted the death of Jews, called for the death of Jews?
Absolutely, absolutely. He was an exterminationist through and through. He thought all Jews should be killed. I mean, he didn't like minorities much either, but he was explicit about that. And the website that he inhabited, Vanguard News Network, is an openly, death to the Jews website as well, fully exterminationist.
I was reading that your organization had contact with his wife on the day of the murder. Do I have that right?
That's right. I happen to know Miller pretty well, having been in a bunch of conversations with him in the fall about his hero, Joseph Paul Franklin, a man who was put to death in November for killing interracial couples. And through that, I met, you know, talked to Marge. So I called her on Saturday when we suspected that it was Miller who had committed these heinous acts in Kansas City. And she was completely unaware of the situation. She just knew that her husband had gone to a casino the prior day and had called her in the morning to say everything was great, he was winning. Wow. So she's someone who's never been in the hate movement. I mean, she, of course, knew what her husband's views were, but she wasn't involved, and she was pretty much in shock once I called.
And I was also reading that, obviously, this week, Passover and also Hitler's birthday is coming up. Do you think that the confluence of those 2 days had some significance for him?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what set him off, you know, especially at the age he was and that he was suffering from emphysema. But there's a few things. Passover is an obvious possible trigger. Also, Sunday was Joseph Paul Franklin's birthday. Uh-huh. If he had, you know, lived and not been executed, that might have played a role here, because he really was Frazier Glenn Miller's hero. Hitler's birthday, April 20th, unfortunately, has inspired a lot of violence, or at least racial activism, over the years. There's also the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing on April 19th. Mm. So all of those are triggers in the radical right for violence.
Help us understand, and these are some of the news accounts that are coming out now, which is that he may have spent some time in the witness protection program. He did apparently testify against some white supremacists. Was he seen as a pariah within the white supremacist world?
Yeah, well, views were sort of split. There were some people who just thought he was a flat-out liar and a snitch and should not be respected at all. But there were other people who felt that he cut that deal with the feds because he was forced to avoid jail time, and that given his long history of violent activism, that he was really a hero, and that all of them have to deal with some sort of nefarious business by the feds at some point in time. So you couldn't really blame Miller for having done that. I mean, at least on Vanguard News Network, he was beloved. He was a very close ally of the site's owner, Alex Linder. And, you know, that didn't come up that much. There are other places where they did bring up the informant business more regularly.
He spent, 3 years in prison? But he also, I don't know how far along in the plot he was, but he was planning on killing or organizing some kind of murder of Morris Dees, the founder of your organization.
Yes, he surely was. He put out a declaration of war. Of course, we sued him to shut down his Klan group in 1984, stop it from doing paramilitary activity and harassing black folks in North Carolina, which it was doing actively. And that's where this hatred for Morris came from, for Miller. What he did is put out a declaration of war that included a point system. If you killed a black person, you got X amount of points. You killed a Jewish person, you got more points. And the most points, I think it was 888, you would get if you assassinated Morris. So, yes, this is an antipathy that goes back deeply, and it landed him in prison for 3 years.
Do you think, based on his writings and what he's accused of doing, that we should rethink our First Amendment or perhaps even rethink how his comments were allowed to exist?
Well, I don't think we should rethink the First Amendment. I think it's a wonderful thing that the United States has created, and I really don't agree with hate speech laws in Germany. I know the history is different, obviously, sure, in certain countries. But what I will say is this. We know where these people are hiding. They're basically in plain sight on websites like VNN and Stormfront.org, the oldest hate site on the web, where there have been 10 killers associated with that website in just recent years, basically since its founding in 1995. The problem in the U.S. has been this. The Department of Homeland Security, which was attacked in 2009 for putting out a report that we should be concerned about right-wing extremism, pulled that report and shut down their domestic non-Islamic unit for domestic terrorism. So they stopped watching right-wing folks for possible signs of coming violence. That's a huge problem. There hasn't been an emphasis, as it should be, in the United States since 9/11 on domestic extremists that are non-Islamic. Domestic right-wing extremists have killed more people since 9/11 here in the United States than Al-Qaeda inspired folks. And yet the emphasis remains on Al-Qaeda for the federal government and not on right-wing people who will pick up a gun.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, obviously there's some political dynamic there. I think there has been a reluctance, certainly was true under the Bush administration, where they refused to even look at right-wing violence. They said that the main domestic terrorism threat was from eco-terrorists, who, by the way, except for the Unabomber, haven't killed anyone, although they've committed many acts of, torching houses and other terrible things.
Right.
So there's like a political dynamic. I think there's a reluctance to look at Christians to some extent, obviously not your mainstream regular Christians, but radical Christians as a source of violence. Maybe there's a little bit of weird racism going on here, a reluctance to look at white folks as domestic terrorists. But those are the people who are committing domestic terrorism here. You just have to think about James von Brunn, who shot up the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and many, many, many violent incidents that have happened, the Georgia militia, the Alaska militia, I could go on, especially since Obama came into office, to realize that this is the bigger problem for us here in the United States.
And that's Heidi Beerich, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly investigative journal. It's called The Intelligence Report. Any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Heidi, just picking up on what you just said, are you saying there have been more acts of extremist violence after the election and then re-election of Barack Obama?
Yeah, we have had an incredible string of domestic terrorism attacks. People sometimes don't realize them because they come up in your paper and you see, oh, this militia group was arrested for X and such. You start lining them up. Since McVeigh bombed the Oklahoma City federal building, there have been more than 100 of these. That pace accelerated after Obama came into office. We had a guy building a dirty bomb who wanted to be a member of the National Socialist Movement, a neo-Nazi group, in Maine. Most people don't know that. We've had attempts by a militia group to release ricin in the streets of, I think, Boston and Atlanta and some other cities. We have had a guy try to blow up the Martin Luther King Day parade, a neo-Nazi, a couple of years ago in Spokane, Washington. If the bomb had gone off, it would have killed hundreds of people. So there has been a whole lot of this, and yet it doesn't, in my opinion, get the attention that it deserves.
Let me quote something, a new report from your organization that you wrote, Heidi, and you begin, "A typical visitor to the racist forum Stormfront.org is a frustrated, unemployed white adult male living with his mother or an estranged spouse or girlfriend. She is the sole provider in the household. Forensic psychologists call him a wound collector." The idea that all these sort of he collects all these slights and insults that have been, he believes, leveled at him?
That's right. That is the profile of that. We're releasing a report in a little bit here about Stormfront, about 10 murderers associated with Stormfront. And that's an accurate depiction of all of them, which is kind of amazing. There are other things about them that are notable. They post at very high frequency. They tend to be misogynistic, for example. And they're obviously all deeply steeped in hate. What these websites do is they give someone an excuse for whatever maybe hasn't worked out in their lives. The reasons why they're unemployed, well, it's the Jews, they're controlling the economy. Or the reason, they can't get a job is because of affirmative action and those horrible black people. And at some point, some of these people snap, mm-hmm. and they start killing people. And that's what the report is about where these people hide in plain sight and the kinds of people that they are.
Well, and I guess the trick is to try to figure out which are the people that might snap and who is maybe just using these websites to vent their hateful speech, but they're never going to act on it.
I completely agree with you. I mean, that is the trick. I mean, why did, Wade Michael Page get up one day and decide, he was a neo-Nazi for a decade and decide to shoot up a Sikh temple? The trigger is unclear. What I do know is that we don't do a lot of studying of these websites and these people, because we don't even have an intelligence unit devoted to this at the Department of Homeland Security to see if there has been a trigger, if there is something that they do that would indicate, violence. I mean, I'm saying all of this within the respect for the First Amendment and the right to post, whatever heinous things you want to do. But we don't even have good studies on these patterns.
I mean, it is, and I raise this with Emily Bazelon, who began the hour, whether that's an argument for, more government surveillance, which, of course, taps into a lot of anxiety that people have.
Sure, I understand that it taps into anxiety, but, we also want to protect the public from these kinds of incidents. And I would say that, at the least, it would be helpful if we had some intelligence folks monitoring stuff mm-hmm. that's available to everybody that's just publicly on the Internet.
Has the government come to you and say, look, we want to, you've been tracking these people, and to say, we want to work with you or we want to use your information to help understand what's going on?
We've had the FBI approach us in the wake of the Linda Miller killings. About what we may or may not know. But no, we have been pushing Department of Homeland Security to revive this non-Islamic domestic terrorism unit, which was decimated after right-wing attacks on their 2009 report. And nothing has happened there. And in general, I would say we've been quite frustrated with government agencies' lack of interest in this kind of extremism.
Have you testified before Congress or a committee in Congress?
We have not testified about this. We have submitted written testimony. Right after the Sikh temple shootings, Senator Durbin held a hearing about what might motivate this kind of hatred and also about what happened at the Department of Homeland Security, but that's the only one I'm aware of.
As you said, you've had conversations with Fraser Glenn Miller. When did you first start talking to him?
It was last fall. I was trying to get contact information for Joseph Paul Franklin, right, who was in prison, and because we wanted to interview him before he was to be executed. And I don't know for what reason Miller took a shine to me, and he just kept calling me back trying
really?
To convince me why I should hate the Jews, basically. So it was sort of a strange string of conversations, I have to say.
Well, I was going to say, how does one have that conversation? How does that go?
Well, when you do the work I do and you talk to these kinds of extremists more frequently, it doesn't seem as bizarre, although when I listen to the audio we put on our website of me talking to him, you realize how crazy it really is.
Right.
But, he was almost jokey about it. He kept, wanting to say to me as a non-Jew with German background that, if he gave me enough evidence about the impending white genocide, I would get what was happening. And he was so conspiratorial and so deeply anti-Semitic and so convinced of his views that he really thought he was going to bring me along. And so I would let him rant, to a certain extent.
Right. Let me get, looks like Rhett from Lewistown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rhett, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Good morning to your guest. My thoughts are on these extremists that are engaged in this kind of thing. that the more attention we give them, the more mainstream that these events become, the more likely they are to, in their draft, bring along copycat type people and events. I am in full agreement with working very hard, you know, in a kind of a lower profile way at identifying disabling, really keeping close tabs on people that are loose cannons like this, but not giving them the satisfaction of making the mainstream news. And hopefully without it, that may have some effect at, minimizing other copycats. Just my thought.
No, I appreciate the call, Rhett. And Heidi, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, as much as we'd like to not give these folks prominence, I worry more about the fact that people need to be aware that this is happening. General awareness about this problem, about hate groups and so on, needs to be there. And the truth is that the copycats would happen either way, if they're going to happen, because these people all talk to each other. So whether the mainstream, or they call it the lamestream media, covers it or not, I don't really think makes a difference.
Are there still threats on the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Oh, absolutely. There are, I think, 40 people in federal prison for trying to kill Morris or blow up our place. So, yeah, it's a constant issue for us.
Well, Heidi Bierich, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times and helping us understand at least a little bit better Fraser Glenn Miller and some of these white supremacist groups.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, she's director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's quarterly investigative journal, and it's called The Intelligence Project. Also in this hour, talked with Daniel Filler. He's senior associate dean and professor of law at Drexel University School of Law. And we began our conversation with Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate Magazine. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter archives, podcasts, satellite radio, email. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.